Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Tina C. of the Living Room Group from Levittown.
Hi guys, I'm Tina. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tina.
I'm going to adjust this. I was given the suggestion to not be afraid of this mic, so I'll try to take suggestions today. My sobriety date is May 7, 2013. My home group is the Living Room Group of Levittown. I'm actually from South Jersey. I have a sponsor who took me through the 12 steps. She is a sponsor, and I sponsor other women in this program. Went through my home group. I have a commitment. I'm the GSR representative, which was like the last one I ever wanted in Alcoholics Anonymous. I kind of like it, come to find out, having a new experience. And yeah, I'll tell you guys a little bit about what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. And about like this mess I made as a direct result of my alcoholism and like the miracle that happened when I let God transform all these mistakes to help other people. So I recently celebrated like 6 years sober, and it's pretty like insane, you know, what happens. The last time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, it wasn't the first time, and I just could not visualize what my life would look like here. I never wanted what you people had. I never wanted to be a part of this fellowship. I just didn't. I didn't want to come in here. I didn't want to help anybody. And come to find out after some action in here, this is like the life that I never wanted, but it's like literally beyond my wildest dreams. I'm extremely fortunate to just be a member of this thing, to come out here in like the mountains in the middle of nowhere. I mean, I guess not to you guys, but to me, this is far away and pretty strange, and just like feel connected to these people that I never met. So I come from an alcoholic family. I don't know how much that matters, other than from like a young age, I was really privy to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a couple aunts and uncles who are sober in this fellowship a long time. My parents are both 1 out of 7 kids, and there's alcoholism on both sides, Irish, Italian, Catholic family. And half of the family, like, doesn't drink, because there's these 2 recovered members of it, and they just never drank. And I remember, at, like, a very young age making a decision that I was never going to get too out of hand and end up like that aunt and uncle. I pitied them. At a young age, like, I registered in my mind that they just made too many wrong choices, and they lost their privilege to drink. And I say that because before I ever had a drink, I fell in love with the effect that alcohol produced in other people. The other side of my family is loud. They drink a lot, and I loved it. You know, I remember being like 3, 4 years old and everybody getting together and watching people start to just unwind and start laughing. And I would see everybody just become better versions of themselves when they started drinking. And it would get insane. And sometimes police would show up. And I loved that, too. It was all very exciting to me. As a little girl, I had this insatiable appetite for enough. Like anything that made me feel good, I wanted more of. I was told like I try to run before I could walk. And I don't know if it matters or not, but I truly believe that I was born with alcoholism. I truly believe that I had a spiritual malady, well before I experienced this physical allergy that happened when I took a first drink. I was never satisfied. Like as a little girl, I remember thinking like, as soon as I can get out of this house, I'm going to be okay. And I had this strong self-will that I would use to accomplish all these things. I would hustle lemonade up and down a lake and make money. And then I'd become a clown and have this successful business. And like anything I wanted to do, I would accomplish. And I was taught that I was a good girl for that. You know, this like self-propulsion thing we talk about in here. If I set my mind on it, I can go out and do it, and that made me good, which would be hard when it comes to surrendering to this thing that I cannot think. But I would grow up, and you know, my mom and my dad divorced at a young age. My mom would remarry a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He wasn't a member when they got married. Shortly after their wedding, she discovered he had a habit, and you know, he would like tear our family apart over and over again. And the weird thing about growing up in an alcoholic household is like, I didn't really know what it was. I just knew that like my mom would get really mad and he would lose his job again. And, I learned that it was easier to lie than to tell the truth. If I wanted to go somewhere, I would just tell you what you want to hear. And just kind of manipulate my way through life. And this would start well before drinking. And I just knew that if I could get out of this little town and I could get out of this house, everything would be okay. And in the chaos of my home, like a lot of things would happen that aren't why I'm an alcoholic, but would give me a whole lot of fuel to justify my drinking, because things happened to me that shouldn't have. And, you know, I was grateful for it because it gave me an excuse every time I got in trouble of why my parents were insufficient and why what I was doing was acceptable, because if you had my life, you would drink too. So like a lot of my memory is really clouded about the years that I drank. But the night that I took my first drink, like I remember as clear as if it happened yesterday. Like I remember the smell in the air. I remember the jeans that I was wearing. I remember exactly where we were and what time it was. And I had purchased a bottle of Everclear. I had this friend who was like a bad girl that I used to go to church with. And I was so grateful that she was in my circle so I could use her as this plug. And I knew that night that I was drinking to get drunk, because I had thought about it for a long, long time. And I started to drink, and I drank for that effect the first time. And as soon as like I really started to feel the effects, it was like I had no idea how afraid I was up until that point in my life, until I wasn't anymore. And all of a sudden, like, I wasn't afraid to just say what I wanted to say. It was like I always knew that you guys would like me and that I was enough, but I was just too afraid to let you see who I was. And, like, alcohol just made me feel okay. You know, I remember, like, coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and thinking I'm, like, this tough girl who's, like, lived in the hood and, like, not being able to look you people in the eyes because I was so full of anxiety and fear. And everybody looked okay and I wasn't. Like, that day that I took that first drink, all of that feeling right in here, it just dissolved. And that night, I picked up other substances that I swore I never would, and I ended up blacking out the first time I ever drank, and I loved it. And everything I ever aspired to be or do in my life from that moment on changed. And I know that's not everyone's experience, but that's mine. I drank like an alcoholic from the first time I put it into my body. And from that moment forward, like, I would do anything I could to just continue to get it as often as I could. Like 14, 15 years old, driving to Camden, to go to a poppy shop that I know would serve me. Just trying to drink as much as possible before school. I didn't really care anymore about what I was supposed to be doing or if I was supposed to go to college. I was just okay. And every time I would get in trouble, I would go to my dad's house. And every time I'd get in trouble there, I'd go to my mom's house. And I started experiencing this common theme in my life that I just couldn't take accountability for absolutely anything I ever did. It was always your fault. It was always the cops in my town. It was always the way that I was raised. And I truly believed that. You know, I felt so sorry for myself. And when I drank, I had the ability to just be present, to just be here right now and find enjoyment in this moment, which I just didn't have without it. And I would go on and I'd start collecting this external unmanageability that, you know, was never my fault. And I never once would think that there was a problem with my drinking. So as a result of this marriage my mom had, she would end up in the Fellowship of Al-Anon, which I resented from the time I was a very little girl. I actually got sent to Alateen, and I didn't even know what I was doing there, and I just wanted nothing to do with it. And so by the time I'm like 16 years old, and my mom finds me like passed out in the driveway in my car, you know, with whatever bottles in the driveway. Like, she would tell me, maybe you need to go to a meeting, you know, and like, it would infuriate me because I would think, because your family is so screwed up, I never even have a chance to drink like a normal person. Like, this is what people do. And I would, like, with a whole heart, hate you people and hate this fellowship and hate those sober members of my family for ruining my chance to be normal, even though I never drank normally. And obviously, I didn't know I was experiencing a physical allergy at the time, but I remember being in high school and going to parties and making these really deliberate decisions to just not ruin the night, you know? Just don't go too hard tonight. Just don't end up waking up somewhere where you don't know where you are. Don't embarrass anybody. Just drink right. And I would try all sorts of things at like 16, 17 years old. Don't drink brown liquor anymore. All these different ways to just try to drink normally, which for me never involved not getting drunk. It just always involved not having embarrassing consequences. And I could never manage that, you know. I smashed a lot of vehicles. I got in a car accident my senior year of high school and I was in a coma. And it's like, I'm terrifying my family members and I'm really like harming everyone around me, and I have no conception of that. I remember, like, waking up in this hospital after being in a coma and thinking, like, I'm not going to be able to go to prom. I'm not going to be able to do this. Like, just insanity with a neck brace on for 9 months. And it's like I tell these stories about my childhood, and I listen to my mom give talks in Al-Anon, and it's like a totally different story, right? Like, we have this disease of perception. I continue to realize that I'll never fully understand the amount of harm I cause the people I love through this process of amends. But so I start to realize that drinking causes consequences for me, and I continue to try to control and change things about it. And by the time I'm like 17 years old, my mom pretty much says, like, you can't do this here. And I would begin to tell myself a story that I was thrown out of my house and my parents just don't care about me. And the truth was, I wasn't allowed to drink alcoholically there. I was always allowed to go to rehab. I was always allowed to come into the house and not destroy everyone's lives. But it would be another thing I would feel sorry for myself for. I would write a sob story and get my way into a college, even though I barely graduated high school. And, you know, go to class for one day, and then no one told me that, like, you have to go. And I would just drink. I would just drink. I would pick up other substances that allowed me to drink longer. And I love every little bit of it, man. Like, I had a lot of fun drinking, even when it wasn't fun. I enjoyed it. It was my identity. And the story would go for me that I would start going to rehabs because I'd get backed into a corner, and I didn't want to go to jail. And that's, like, my truth up until the last time I came in here. I never said, like, wow, a life in sobriety sure looks appealing. And I'm really tired of hurting the people I loved. It was just that I didn't want to go to jail. So I would start to go to these treatment centers. And I remember, like, going to a rehab and going in because I was backed into a corner and things got bad. And just thinking, like, how much I'm not like you people. You know, and how, like, I'm going to get my life together. I got to let go of that dude. I got to get a better job. I got to get back into school and really straighten things out. And believing that everything was going to be okay and getting out of there with every intention of cleaning my life up and not making it very long before I pulled it all down again. And every time I would pick up, things would get worse and worse. And I remember being in, like, my third treatment center and thinking, you really better stop going to rehab or they're really not going to let you drink at Thanksgiving. They're going to think you're actually an alcoholic. And I don't know if this is characteristic for everyone, but for me, I'm just that delusional. I'm just that delusional. I truly believe that it's never as bad as it is. I'm just not that bad, you know, and I'm going to get it together. And I would hold on to any piece of evidence that I'm doing good, whether it be a car in the driveway. It doesn't matter if it's insured or registered. Whether it be a job that I can manage to hold for any period of time, it doesn't matter how much I'm depending on alcohol to be okay. As long as I have any of these things to show you I'm doing fine, I think I'm fine. And, over the next few years, like, this thing would progress for me to a point that I wasn't allowed in my family's homes anymore because I was stealing everything and I was selling jewelry and, you know, I didn't have keys to their homes and I didn't care. It was just, you know, I felt so sorry for myself. That I had a family that didn't love me, and I truly believe that, you know. And I remember, like, coming to Christmas, and, you know, my dad got remarried and had these two little girls that I didn't even know. And, like, looking at them and having these little rare moments where I would want to love them. And I would honestly just want to be a sister to them, but just not being capable. You know, this disease just disconnected me from my ability to just care about connecting to anyone, you know, and things got lonelier and lonelier. And I would pick up some other substances and, you know, have these other profound experiences where, like, I would make these conscious decisions in my mind that this is how I'm supposed to die. And everyone would be so much better without me. And I became completely unemployable. I became completely incapable of being honest with the people around me. And this mom in Al-Anon would try to get in touch with me, and she would say, Tina, where are you? Why don't you go to a meeting? And I would, you know, lash out on her and say, how dare you? And she would come meet up with me in my Section 8 apartments, and I'd have her meet me on the highway, and she'd bring me a rotisserie chicken, and I would scream bloody murder until she would give me $10, and she wouldn't. And she'd go away, and she said, there's people who will help you. And I just resented this place, you know. And there were times that I would come to these meetings because I had to for probation or whatever consequences. and I wanted nothing to do with it. I just had no willingness in my heart to give this even half a try. You know, I had no desire to be sober, which, you know, is important to some extent here when we come in. And, you know, like I have a hard time talking about these years. It's all very foggy, like going in and out of treatments and my consequences getting worse. And I could tell you like there would be moments where I knew that if I would go to probation on a Monday morning and I wouldn't pass that test that I was going to jail, and I would really know that I was going to get it together, and it would be Saturday morning and I would be incapable of stopping. And I would make these elaborate plans Sunday to go to the vitamin shop and get niacin and all this stuff and clean my system. And it would be Monday morning and I'd be going to pick somebody's urine up to take that test, and I would go to get it and I would just not even make it and accept a few warrants. Because I really still think, as I'm just destroying my life, that I'm making these decisions to do what I want to do. And I have absolutely no choice and I just can't see it, you know? And it, the truth is, for somebody like me, it doesn't matter how many consequences I have or I don't. You know, this thing is going to progress either way. My inability to stop is going to continue to drive me to do things I don't want to do and go places I don't want to go with people I don't want to go with. And, you know, like I said, it got lonelier and things started getting really bad. And I would have these moments where I really just wanted to die. You know, I didn't try to commit suicide, but I remember trying to wean myself off and laying in a bed in this apartment, just screaming to who knows what. Just saying, like, everyone would be so much better off without me, just obsessing about myself and my life and this pain that I'm in, and just wanting to stop. But like the idea of going to a clinic or going to a therapist or trying all these things to try to get better, like, it just seemed so out of reach to me. There wasn't even like an inkling of hope in me. And, I don't know. I was, dating this beautiful drug dealer who was just the love of my life. I just knew that we were meant to be together, and we would go out and we would make money and we would argue because I'd steal all the supply. And I remember we moved in with this woman, Mary, who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she relapsed, but she was like sober for 30 years. And she was like a 65-year-old hippie, and she let us live with her because we sold her scripts, and you know how that goes. And we can't, you know, I was completely hopeless. My family wasn't speaking to me, and I came home one day and she was dead on the couch. And the day after that, I found out I was pregnant. And the day after that, I found out this man that was supposed to build a life with me was going to be going to prison for a long, long time. And like, for the first time in my life, I realized like, I really need to stop. And I have no idea how to manage my way out of this one. And, you know, like any normal person would accept help, you know, go on to the bitter end, or accept spiritual help. And I just couldn't do it. You know, I remember writing my mom this long letter about how we were going to have this baby and everything was going to be okay. And she just looked at me and was like, no, like, you have no idea how sick you are. And, I remember like with great intentions, I robbed that guy right before he went to jail, and I had an abortion, and I lied and I said it was a miscarriage, and I moved in with another man. And like, that's how I drink. That's how I get by in life. I just do whatever I need to do to survive and continue to drink the way I need to drink. Not how I was raised. I was raised by hardworking, loving people who really wanted me to do well in life, and I had no moral compass, no ability to do anything right. And I would go on drinking again, and at this point I would really start to have a desire to stop. And I remember, you know, like, I didn't mind going to rehab. I kind of liked a little break to, you know, meet some friends, have a place to sleep. And like, that's not normal. It became really normal to me to be institutionalized. And I remember I picked the sobriety date that I really wanted to stick. It was 10, 11, 12. And I knew if I got it tattooed on me, it would last forever. And so I like went to this rehab, and I had got some major charges right before that. And I, for the first time, went in there with like an honest desire to stop. And I'm completely physically separated, and I'm like 3, 4, 5 days in, and I'm getting physically ill at the idea of what this would feel like, right? Because I'm experiencing this thing called a mental obsession that I have no idea what's happening. I just know that I'm so sick, and if I don't get out of this place, I'm going to kill someone. That's how I feel when you take me away from alcohol. no matter how my body is. And for the first time, like, somebody suggested I just get on my knees and pray, and I did it, and I don't know why, but it worked. It was the strangest thing. And I had just, like, a little bit of hope that, like, maybe there's something in this world or there's something to it. I went through this treatment center, and I just listened a little more, and they sent me to another place for other problems. And for the first time, I came into AA, like, just with my ears a little bit open. I used to come late and leave early and usually meet a nice boyfriend. And this lady, like, grabbed me by the back of my shirt, and she told me she was going to be my sponsor. She was super abrasive. I remember going to her house totally against my will. I just went, and she sits me down in this living room, and there's cats everywhere. I don't like cats. I'm allergic to them. She pulls out a big bowl of Edamame, and I was weirded out. It's like, alcoholics are strange. And I'm sitting there, and she gives me a big book, and I'm like, I'm not an alcoholic. I do drugs. And she starts reading the doctor's opinion of me. And, like, this thing that I can't explain started to happen in my heart because I started to identify with what it was talking about. And it was, like, treatment center after arrest, after every bit of external unmanageability that would, you know, give me some evidence that maybe I have this thing called alcoholism. For the first time, I would think, like, maybe I really have this thing. And like, I just want to, like, point out that, like, that is just insanity, the depths of my own delusion, the things that I can believe to be true. But I've come to rely on my own thoughts, and it's such a scary thing because my mind will never solve my problem. And so I started to have a little experience with her, and I would start to fall in love with this fellowship. I would go into that basement, and I would stop to feel. I would stop feeling so afraid. You know, I would start recognizing some people, and they would treat me with respect and love, and they would remember my name and bring me to AA dances, and I would kind of want this thing that was going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I can think of, like, a million memories of, like, a speaker that I heard or a person who touched my heart in some way before I stayed sober, but Alcoholics Anonymous was working way before I was ready to surrender to this thing. And I would get, like, 3 or 4 months sober and be really excited about getting these coins, especially because I usually get to come up to a place like this and talk about myself. And I loved all the attention. And I would leave a meeting and with, like, no intention of ruining all this sobriety time I put together. Or my family really starting to trust me again, I would pick up. And it was, like, the first time I really experienced powerlessness. Like, I thought that step one was, like, a list of charges I wrote down to prove what alcoholism was, and I really missed the mark here. You know, I really just never believed until that moment that I lacked the power to not pick up that drink without accessing this power. You know, I failed to mention that she took me to a 4-step, and I thought, oh, no, that looks like homework, and I put it off. And you know, I really thought I knew what Alcoholics Anonymous was, and I really thought that I had given it an honest shot, and I went on, like, the worst run of my life. I lived in North Camden, and like, the next few months would be encompassed by this pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, you know, where I wanted to die. I wasn't even experiencing the effects of this, the only thing that ever made me feel okay. And once again, I destroyed the lives of these family members around me. And I don't know, man, I would have this week, this mom in Al-Anon said, hey, why don't you go to this convention? I'll get you a room there. So I thought, sure. I went back and forth from Camden to the Crown Plaza in Cherry Hill, and I went to this Area 45 convention. And I sat around alcoholics for a whole weekend, and I couldn't breathe a sober breath, and I desperately wanted to be sober. I would rob dollars out of the Seven Tradition and go get what I needed and come back. And I love when I see people like that in Alcoholics Anonymous, because sometimes we think, like, what are they doing here? Like, I couldn't stop, and I wanted to be sober, you know? And you people were the only people that looked at me like I was a human being. I'd be walking down the street, and people would pass me in their cars and lock the door. And you people touched me, and you offered me cigarettes, and you showed me this love that really only God really saw anymore, you know, because of the way that I was living. And I would run back to the suburbs to scrap some metal, and I would see two members of Alcoholics Anonymous that I knew from my old home group, and they'd ask me how I was doing, and they'd give me a hug, and they'd give me their pack of cigarettes, and I'd take the bus back to do what I was doing. And for no particular reason, one day I was on Admiral Wilson Boulevard, and I looked up at the sky, and a thought that wasn't mine came into my head that was, why don't you try doing everything those people said to do? you know? Convinced that I was meant to die an alcoholic death. Convinced that there was no hope for somebody like me. My consequences were so vast. I had so many open court dates and so many banks that I couldn't go to. And I had destroyed my family so much that it just didn't even seem worth trying. And this thought came, like, why don't you just try doing what those people were doing? And I wore this big skull ring and it had a big pipe hanging out of its mouth that someone in the hood gave me. And I wore it like a badge of honor. And all of a sudden it just dropped to the floor and I heard a cling. And I don't know if this even happened or if it was like a hallucination, but I knew that God was real. Right? And God doesn't make too hard terms for those who seek him. And for me, God always meets me where I am, no matter how cognizant I am, no matter how capable I am of understanding what's going on around me or knowing where I am in this journey. He meets me right where I am and he gives me just enough to keep going. And I went to treatment one more time. I was shooting for Cinco de Mayo. I missed the flight. And I've been sober since May 7th of 2013. And I would love to tell you that, like, the journey's been all linear from there. And I got armed with the facts, went through this process, trusted God, clean house, and helped others. And that's not my experience in sobriety at all. But it's the most beautiful journey. If you're new here and you don't know what it's going to look like, you know, this is my story, but please have your own. You know, I wasted a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous trying to duplicate other people's experiences. Like, what a beautiful thing to have our own journey with our own personal God. But I went down to Florida. I wasn't allowed to leave the state of New Jersey. My ex-boyfriend relapsed to be in rehab with me because he really loved me. And I had just sworn a few days earlier that I would do anything I needed to do to be okay. I'm going to try this thing called AA. I'm going to get a home group and get a sponsor. And I'm going to go through all 12 steps. And if it doesn't work, I'll come back here. I had made that decision. And I'm a few days in there, and I'm thinking of all these ideas about how I'm going to recreate my life already. And they don't involve those things. They involve a job. They involve all these just genius things that I'm thinking of how it's going to get better. And I leave that treatment center with that guy, and I end up managing a halfway house. Mind you, I've never stayed sober in my life. I'm driving a van around with no license. And, like, this might be an extreme case, but this is what I suffer from. I think I know what I need. Even when I say I really don't know what I need, my mind convinces me we are going to figure this out. And I'm down there, and girls are dying, man. Girls are picking up one after the other. The guy who owned that treatment center is now in jail for the rest of his life because it was such a corrupt facility. And I have no idea why God saw me through it other than to live the life that I'm living now. You know, he knew that there was some point and keeping me sober, but I get a month sober, I get 2 months sober. I'm getting more time, and I'm feeling worse and worse. Some days I wake up feeling like I can't breathe, and I can't explain why, and I'm walking to meetings, and I'm using my food stamps, and I'm trying to encourage people with all this frothy appeal about how good it's going to get later, and it's not working. People are picking up left and right, and I know I'm going to die down there. And by the grace of God, all I had was prayer. I begged this God to show me what to do, and I called that weird cat lady. And I asked her for some help again. And she would do the exact same thing with me. She would start reading that book with me on the phone. And I would end up back at a Oxford house in New Jersey. And I had to begin this process for real, you know. And I just, for whatever reason, was given just this grace that looked like willingness to just show up and start taking some suggestions. And I walked to meetings every day. And, like, early sobriety was really challenging for me. I think it's really challenging for a lot of people. And it's important to talk about that, like, it doesn't always feel good that you're here and you're sober, you know? I caused a lot of harm. People don't want me around just because I'm sober. They're not telling me I'm such a good girl anymore. Sobriety's not enough, right? I walked to meetings every day. I had to go to court cases, and I just start embarking on this journey of the steps. And, like, thank God for that woman. I would not be here today without her. But she was never taken through the 12 steps as outlined through the big book. I got sober at a beautiful meeting full of loving people who told me to just not drink. And they taught me how to make coffee, and they really showed me a whole lot of love. And they taught me about this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. They taught me about this unity piece of the triangle. But I came to believe that what I was doing, showing up at meetings and sharing about how I was feeling, was recovery. I thought that's what it was. And, you know, life did start to get better. I started to believe in this God that kept getting bigger, because I'd show up to a court date and the prosecutor wasn't there, and I wouldn't end up going to jail, or I'd be walking home from a meeting and stumble upon a pack of cigarettes, and like these little dumb spiritual experiences for me would begin to happen, which would make me start to really believe in this thing. And I love being a part of this fellowship. I went to meetings every single day, sometimes twice a day. And I get sober and I get a little job at Starbucks, and alcoholics come in all the time to check on me. And I don't know, as I'm staying sober, like I stop being as excited about just showing up here. And I start, you know, feeling like walking around the hallways during my home group, and I don't know why. And I start not really being the best daughter. Like I'm leaving Thanksgiving dinner early to run to an Alcathon because it's too painful to be around them, right? But I think I'm doing really good in Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm speaking and I'm showing up. And, like these behaviors get worse and worse for somebody like me. I started to experience these bedevilments, in unbelievable ways in my life. And this is just my experience, which happened for some particular reason. But I start doing things like borrowing money out of the safe. I'm going to put it back in the next morning. And I'm like a year sober, member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? I'm not making financial amends. I think I can say a couple I'm sorrys and everybody's going to forgive me. But my family's more resentful at me with some time sober than they were when I was drinking, because I have no excuse left anymore to be so inconsiderate. And I start having trouble with every relationship in my life, and I start thinking, if this is what Alcoholics Anonymous is, I really don't want it. Right? And I would try to fix this problem that was deep-rooted in my soul with everything. I would start lifting weights and become like the man of my own dreams, squatting 465 pounds like a psychopath. I would spend every paycheck at the mall, anything and everything, because I just wasn't okay. And I would say, like, I don't meditate, I lift weights. I didn't think anybody really did 10-11. I thought it was just something we said to sound good. And I truly never had an experience as a result of all 12 of these steps, but I had so much knowledge that I used it as a weapon to defend myself here and keep you a little ways away from me. And what would happen is, you know, I would hit another surrender in sobriety to the unmanageability of my life running on self-will, to the unmanageability that accumulates when I'm just trying to do this on my own without relying on God, without experiencing this change. And I would get arrested in sobriety. I would lose my job in sobriety. Things would look bad, you know, and I would get sponsor after sponsor after sponsor and say, you need to do another four-step with me. You need to give me a new sex inventory. I would tell them what I need. Right? And these poor women would be like, just relax. And so there was like this little woman running around, and she would be holding up big books, like just so joyful, saying, if anybody wants an experience with this book, I'd love to help you. And she would make me sick to my stomach. And people would say, call her. Why don't you meet with her? And I thought, she can't help me. I have more time than her. She can't help me. She's married and I have man problems. She can't help me. She's happy all the time and she must be on Prozac. Like, there was just no way I was letting this woman into my life. And I found myself at her kitchen table having yet another experience with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, for the first time in my life, like, I was convinced that of myself I was nothing. And then I really didn't have this thing figured out. And, like, with some time sober, my hands shook and my heart beat out of my chest. And I still thought I knew what alcoholism was, and I really didn't. And I became open-minded. I love that set-aside prayer you were read in the beginning of the meeting, because it's like every day I wake up thinking I know. And every day I have to strip myself of all these things that my ego wants to hold on to, and all these ideas I have about who I'm supposed to be and what I'm supposed to do to open myself up to have the experience I meant to have. And I don't know, I would read those words and like something different would begin to happen, for me. And right away she would take me to recovery houses with her and tell me to just start reading. And like, I would fall in love with this thing that would happen when all I would do is share my own experiences and connect with this program that was already written with these other women. And it would fill my heart up in a way that like the gym couldn't, the dude couldn't, all these other things couldn't. And I had gotten on my knees probably 5 times before that and took this third step with other women. And for the first time, something happened where, like, I truly came to believe that, like, maybe I should actually try to let go absolutely. Like, what does that look like for each of us, even today? What does letting go absolutely mean? What does trusting God with my money look like? What does trusting God with my relationships look like? What does trusting God with his plans that aren't mine look like? It's challenging. Very simple stuff we learn here. Not easy, right? I would write this inventory again in sobriety, probably my fourth step, and just be absolutely humiliated and disgusted with the person that I'm capable of being when I'm really trying to be a good girl in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I didn't want to be here anymore. And this huge jump between I don't want to be that person and truly looking at the fact that I am driven by fear every day to the point that I'm suffocating. You know, I'm looking around Alcoholics Anonymous resentful because she drives an Audi and there everyone just seems to be doing okay here and I'm dying inside, right? Comparing my insides to other people's outsides, absolutely unwilling to take responsibility for my life by asking God to change me because I just can't do it on my own. And I would humbly ask him every day, literally ask him, please get me out of the way. Please take away everything that gets in the way of my ability to be useful. And I would start to see that God kept me so sick for a reason because there are a whole lot of people like me in Alcoholics Anonymous that just don't know what this answer is, that just don't know what freedom looks like, that just don't know that it's possible to go anywhere without wanting to drink, and that there's a lot more to this deal than sobriety, right? And that recovery offers a freedom that I've never experienced. And all this contempt prior to investigation that I had would be so quickly taken away by like just unbelievable, miraculous experiences that God would start to show me in my own life. And so I would get to these amends, right? I'm still making amends with 6 years sober. I caused a whole lot of harm. And I would be taught like what it actually means to make something right, what it actually means to approach these people from my past. And tell them exactly what I did to them and ask them what I left out and how I can make it right. And the truth is, we were talking about it on the ride up here, like, this is scary, right? See, you know, I make it all about me. I'm so afraid. But the truth is, I'm also so selfish. I don't want to give my little bit of money back. I don't want to really swallow the truth about the way I hurt you in the past. And if I'm not convinced that I have alcoholism, and if I don't take these actions, I'm not going to stay sober. If I'm not convinced that I have a loving God who's going to carry me through this, and you guys have already done it, and God kept you safe and protected, I'm not going to do it. And I would begin one after another approaching these people. My license was suspended. My bank account was overdrawn. And I would just go and do it anyway. You know, I was told by the sponsor that it's not your money, and God would... You know, there was not a shadow of doubt when I would begin to embark on this actual journey of writing the past that there wasn't a God who's been with me the whole time. The most miraculous things began to happen. It turns out people really want their money back. You know, I hear a lot of my girls say, they just said stay sober and do the next right thing. Mine are like, yeah, we could set up a payment plan. That sounds great. But I would, you know, I'm like on unemployment. I'm like, sick with Hep C, going through treatment years ago before it was like everyone has Hep C, and I'm like, my life is so horrible. When is God going to care about me? And I would start cleaning up my past, and God would just completely transform my life. You know, I would take this shitty job as a part-time telemarketer, like making less money than unemployment because it was a spiritual thing to do, and I would be given this beautiful opportunity to sit down with alcoholics almost every day and share with them this message that we have here. And a lot of them wouldn't stay sober, and I would continue to make these amends, and God would continue to transform my financial landscape as I started to give people back the money that was rightfully theirs. And I would continue to learn how selfish and self-centered I actually am, because we can all say, yeah, I know I'm selfish. But when you hear things that you never even remember doing, and you hurt people in ways you never could remember hurting them, it gave me this real willingness to become the woman that God actually created me to be, and not this idea of the girl I think I'm supposed to be, right? And this humility entered my heart that I couldn't have made up. I couldn't have just materialized by wishing or willing it into existence. And, you know, this, like, I'm the type of person, like, I get resentful almost every day, right? I have, like, these beautiful tools that I can continue to practice in my life. To see things from a different angle, to look at my own selfishness and dishonesty, and like, thank God. But like, apparently people really use the 10th step. I had no idea that there were people in Alcoholics Anonymous who genuinely went through life with this little spot checked inventory and calling other alcoholics and before any of that, asking God to remove it. And like, this idea of God, I used to think like, I'm so busy, I can't fit it all into my life. And it was like, what began to happen for me is like, I just made my life fit into AA. right? Like, I just served God, and he figured the rest out. And, like, I would end up going back to school and working on a movie and like all these things that made no sense for like a convicted felon who robs or safe at work sober would start to happen for me. And like God would start to change my heart and I would just learn like all these experiences would happen. Somebody stole my phone at my home group, right? And I'm like just really trying to just give everything to God. And I see the girl, she's nodding out. I know she took my phone. She was the only one in the coffee bar and the meeting's over and I go in and the phone's gone and I go up to her. And I'm like, hey, have you by any chance seen an iPhone? It was plugged in there when you just walked in and you were the only one in there. And she'd say, nah, no idea. And I'll be sitting there and I just, you know, like my instincts kick in and I want to throw her on the floor and rip my phone out of her pocket. And I have these people that I start surrounding myself with who are like, the spiritual life is not a theory, you know? Trust God. Like, you'll get another phone. I'm like, what? Like, it's painful. Change is painful. It's unnatural. And I'm like, God, please help me not strangle this girl. And I let her go and it'd be the next morning and like my Find My iPhone app would ding and it'd go to this motel and I'd get a ride to this motel and I'm like, what am I even doing here, God? Why did I come here? And I'd go and talk to this like Indian guy at the counter and he'd be like, I can't help you. And I'd be like, what am I doing here? And all of a sudden she'd walk out and I'd see her and she'd start running and I'd run after her and I'd say, it's okay, I forgive you. And end up taking the girl to a detox. Like all these just crazy things started happening and I'd be like, okay. So there's like everything has a purpose and everything has a meaning and everything that's hard is an opportunity to grow closer to him. Right? It's like the most beautiful life and I just started accepting everyone in my life as being exactly the way they were supposed to be. I fell in love with this family that I wanted nothing to do with. Right? As a result of an amends, I would have dinner with my family every Sunday night and fall in love with these two little sisters I didn't know. And I can't imagine going a day without seeing them. Right? And like we all have different journeys, but like I would hear people come up here and talk about achieving things sober and getting married and getting degrees and be sick about it. Cause I thought all I'm going to do is go to meetings and diners and that's it. Right. And, like as soon as I started just following this process, I didn't have to find a relationship with God. It just found me. I didn't have to try to figure anything out anymore. I just had to woke up every day and ask him what he wanted and show up and do that and stop talking about my problems and start helping you with yours and God just solves them, you know? And I used to say like, I don't meditate. I lift weights. I was like a sober crackhead for years running around meeting, drive everywhere. And, like somebody sat down with me and showed me exactly what they did. And I started asking people that had, what is that? A bat? Welcome. Interesting.
It's a bear, small bear.
I love bears. But either way, I would ask people who had like a light turned on in them in Alcoholics Anonymous what they did. Like I stopped being so focused on making meetings and being anything here other than useful. I stopped going to meetings where my friends went and started just showing up at a place and looking for the person who was smoking a cigarette by themselves and might never come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Like when I really take a third step decision. Like, it's not like, okay, let's do the rest of the steps. It kind of is. But what it starts to look like for me every day is like truly being useful when I go to work, not being on Facebook all day. And when I'm around my family, not talking about me and Alcoholics Anonymous the whole time. And when I show up at a meeting looking for the person who I can help, right? It's not about coming here to hear the right message and getting what I need out of it. And so I would learn to meditate and start to have like really profound experiences with these parts of my life that I held on to so desperately, with these areas of unmanageability that I just couldn't let God into. I would learn to be quiet and it would get easier through practice to like actually listen and God would start, like I would receive an inspiration and a connection that I just couldn't otherwise experience. And the longer I stay here, the more I come to rely on that to just be okay. Right? The more I desperately need to seek this power to be okay, no matter how long I've been here. But, you know, for years I felt like I was sitting down with anyone who would open that book with me and just trying desperately to carry this message and showing up and being resentful when a girl had a nicer car than me, but doing it anyway. And like, you know, I'm not God, right? And I can't make anybody willing to go through this process. In fact, the majority of women who I begin this process with don't stay sober. But when I'm willing to just continue to help whoever's in front of me with only one intention, which is to offer to them this solution, like unbelievable things would begin to transpire that like outweigh any accomplishment that I've ever had in sobriety, right? Watching like maybe 1 out of 10 women just willing to do this and seeing them come to believe in God and seeing what God does in their life and seeing women become moms again and daughters again. And like, who am I? Right? And seeing them go out and repair their path and getting those phone calls of them all lit up about these unbelievable things that God's doing in their lives, like excitement, and hearing them tell me about the women that they're helping. It is the most important thing in my life. And I didn't want to be one of those people who like live to serve Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the most beautiful gift I've ever been given. I used to hate how people would say like, this is a life beyond my wildest dreams. And, you know, you help me more than I help you. And I get it. You know, no matter what is going on in my life, God always makes a way that I can suit up and show up and carry this message. And it's never in the way. It is the way. And, so like over the last few years, Alcoholics Anonymous, what this unity looks like continues to look differently for me. My sponsor would have women over her house on Sundays, and I would move out and get an apartment, and I would start to have women over my house, and we'd have book studies, and I would just kind of do what she did. I would have people over and introduce them to meditation. I would move to Northeast Philadelphia and get a home group I didn't want because there was like a million people there in recovery houses who had no idea what was going on or what we were about here. And I would fall in love with another group of alcoholics and build a new fellowship. And just by showing up and being useful, you know, God, like my experience here is that God gives me everything I want. But the problem is like I have alcoholism and I get it. And I'm like, it doesn't feel the way I thought it would feel. Right. I want something else. And I don't know. A lot of this deal for me looks like more discipline. It looks like constantly seeking this relationship with God, and it's brought me to churches, and it's brought me to people's living rooms where they're burning sage and doing weird stuff that I'm really uncomfortable with, and having brand new experiences so this God can keep getting bigger, right? I'm the type of person that needs to continue to go through inventories because I get blocked off, and I don't know. So I'm going to talk about like the last year of my sobriety. It was crazy. Like I was, you know, I don't talk about it always, but like this sex inventory portion of the big book, like I thought, I think it's often overlooked, but like I started saying like really specific prayers that are in there about molding me into the ideal of the woman that God would have me be, right? And creating this ideal by sitting with God of the man God would have me be with, and like really saying these sex fears, and God would just transform this part of my life. And like, I would enter like, relationships with like healthy, not sick people. And like start to be capable of these intimate, lasting relationships. And like all of a sudden I find myself as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with like everything I ever wanted, like a great man. And, you know, we're buying a home and we have a dog and he's in the union, and it's like everything I ever wanted. Right. But like, he just doesn't understand this purpose that I'm living with. He's resentful that I'm running to Kensington on a Wednesday night to pick up a girl. He's resentful of all these women in her home, and he's a good person. But like doing my part, going through the traditions and really applying that to my relationship, you know, writing down these inventories every night and really asking God like where I'm at fault, like really allowing myself to stay sponsored and stay teachable about these things that don't sit right in my spirit. And I ended up like leaving a man and a house and like this whole life that I thought was a gift from God, because it's just not where I thought God wanted me to be. And it's, you know, at the same time, a girl that I sponsored who had like 9 months sober, who I absolutely adored, I picked her up homeless on the streets of Maryland and got her into a detox, and I watched God transform her life. I watched her fall in love with this process like so many others. I fell in love with this woman. You know, these women I take through the steps, they're my friends. They walk shoulder to shoulder with me and they do this deal. And she picked up and she overdosed and died. Right. And I'm still, no matter how much God does in my life, I can say, why are you doing this? right? Don't tell me this is God's will. Don't tell me this is his plan. Why, God? I do everything you want. Why is this so hard? But showing up anyway and being useful and calling that girl's mom and telling her what happened and saying the eulogy at her funeral. You know, the day I'm settling on a home, about to leave this relationship, my grandfather dies 3 weeks later, my grandmother dies 3 weeks later. And like, I don't mean it to sound any type of way, but like, I can look at it all now as like this beautiful gift of coming to trust God more, of being able to show up anyway and be useful, of holding my grandmother's hand as she died next to me with complete insecurity of what was going on around me, knowing that like, I wasn't that girl who 7 years ago begged her to bail me out of the police station or I was going to kill myself. I was the granddaughter who showed up and took her to church, you know, and who made an honest amends to her and did that through the way I lived and the way I showed up for her and asked her everything I wanted to ask. And just like some of the most painful times in my sobriety end up being the most beautiful times because I have nothing left to do but rely on God absolutely, you know, and in a short amount of time, I move and I'm just glued into this life by these beautiful women that I help. And, this purpose that I have, it's like all these things I rely on to be okay can fall apart all around me and I can just be at peace anyway. And that's the biggest gift I ever got in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, yes, it's a huge deal that somebody like me can go for years and not drink. I went to school. I just graduated college, in North Camden, where I used to live homeless, walking past the sets where I used to be at, places I've been arrested, free. You know, sometimes bawling my eyes out, walking to class, like, God, what have you done in my life? Right? That's an unbelievable gift. But the ability to match calamity with serenity, to bring usefulness when everybody's falling apart, it's not who I am. It's what God wants us all to be, what we're supposed to do here. And it's just an unbelievable life, you know? I'm like, just recently went to Florida to do some research. I'm getting a master's degree in public health. Like, I'm telling you, I'm an idiot. I'm a convicted felon. I drop out of school. I'm not capable of anything. I did like post-production on a movie. I just left the film festival this weekend. And my life really is, it's hard to believe that it's mine. I was in these gorgeous mountains in New York this weekend, staying in a hotel, everything paid for. And I woke up Saturday morning. I had a friend come up with me. And I woke up miserable because I have alcoholism. You know, like people say that, like I wake up alcoholic, like I wake up ungrateful for everything that I have, just feeling some type of way for no particular reason. And it is an imperative that I connect to this power and I ask him, what he wants me to do? And to get me out of the way. And every mistake I've made along the way here makes me so much more useful. Nobody, like I'm not the type of person that can be helped from someone who's perfect. You know, my sponsor is completely transparent with me with where she's separated from God, you know, and what she's going through. And I try to do the same with everyone else in my life. I try to just live in a way that I don't have to lie about anything. And I let people into my homes and into my family. And I treat my alcoholism every day, you know, and I love the effects produced by Alcoholics Anonymous and helping other people. My life is absolutely beyond my wildest dreams. And like, I can honestly say in this moment, which hasn't always been the truth for me, that I want what God wants for me more than anything. All I want is to trust his plans. I told my employer today, who I've worked for years, that I'm going to leave, and I'm going to take an opportunity to move to Florida. It's like this beautiful, God-inspired opportunity, and he didn't tell me that he hated me, and I didn't, you know, just leave a job and not tell him. He said, it's been such a privilege to have you and you're welcome here every time. And Alcoholics Anonymous has turned me into the woman that's welcome places anytime, right? I can't thank you people enough for being here. And for anybody who's new, like, there's more hope than you can even imagine. There's a life that you aren't even capable of imagining here, you know, but you have to uncover and discover who you really are and find out what this power has in store for you. Don't miss the opportunity, you know? That's all I got.